I would like to offer some reflections in this afternoon slot on the theme of the Brahma Viharas. And again, as I'm sitting here, I'm wondering how all of you are feeling in this moment. I certainly feel like I'm still arriving and landing here. And somehow it feels important to, feels helpful, maybe for me, perhaps for you, just to acknowledge that we're very much in the process of landing and arriving and this curious transition from whatever circumstances of life we're coming in from, arriving here on retreat together. And although it's very familiar to me, I still feel like it's quite a shift. It's quite a shift in a lot of ways. It's a different environment of landing in together with this time, this particular group of people, many familiar people, but still a shift from my ordinary environment, and I imagine for all of you as well. It's a shift in the rhythm of sleep and waking. I somehow found myself very, that kind of sudden, waking up in the morning on the first day of the retreat at 5:30 with this kind of energy and brightness and sense, this sense of like, oh, I didn't sleep that much, but I'm, yeah, that was the night is now over. That sense, felt unquestionable sense in the energy body of there's no way back in right now. Just naming that, I don't know how it was for each of you, but I imagine can be special. And also acknowledging some of you have traveled from further away, different time zones. That's a different adjustment as well. And it's like we'll feel that. You'll feel that in the body, in the heart, the mind. So again, it can be sometimes helpful to name these things and acknowledge them. And of course, we're here supported and held by our wonderful group of managers and all of the food that they offer, the Nirodha food. It really suits me, and I find it so supportive. And that's also a shift, perhaps, for some of you from what you're used to. And it's like that will be felt in the body, in being here. And also the shift in the intensity of practice, of suddenly finding ourselves like, okay, now it's a full schedule of retreat, of meditation. We're sort of easing into it with the slower morning, this morning, but we'll be sitting more and just again to name. That's an adjustment. It's an adjustment just merely on the physical level, but also for the psyche, for the citta, for the heart mind. So I don't know, are you feeling some of this shift, this change? And it's I feel like sometimes, especially when it's, this is a more experienced group, there's a lot of people with a lot of retreat experience here, but it can be still useful to name it and say, okay, this is where we're at, and this is why my body feels this way, why the heart feels this way, why the mind is going through whatever movements we're going through. So I said I'd like to offer some reflections on the Brahma Viharas, on kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And you could say these are qualities of the heart that the Buddhist meditative tradition encourages us to develop, to cultivate, to practice. That this is something wholesome. This is something deeply supportive, supporting happiness, supporting well-being on a really profound, important level. These are also qualities that can lead to freedom, to insight, to understanding, to wisdom, support that, for form an important ground for all of that. And if we pause to look more closely at the word Brahmavihara, this Pali word, it's composed, it's made of two words, the first one being Brahma, referring to God, and the second, Vihara, as Catherine mentioned earlier, a dwelling place or a living place, an abiding. So, literally translated as divine abidings, the places where the gods live. And with the theme of the retreat, I just wanted to pause there for a while. It has the divinities present in the practices and the name of the practices. And perhaps many of you are aware, traditional Buddhism has a rich cosmology of different kinds of realms. This is part of the description of the world. There's the human realm, the animal realm, different divine realms, realms of more confusion and suffering. And we could understand these in a lot of different ways. And one way is to understand, to interpret these as saying something about our experience, something about the nature of our experience. So often when the Buddha talks about the world, when he refers to the world, he's referring to the world of our experience, our perception. There's a famous sutta, the Loka Sutta, meaning the sutta of the world, the teaching on the world, where he begins by saying, "I will teach you the origination of the world and the ending of the world. Listen and pay close attention. I will speak." And then he goes on to describe how consciousness and perception arise, co-arise from the senses, are dependent on the sense organs, and how through the reactivity of the mind, the push and the pull, grasping, our sense of self comes into existence in some particular way, bound up in the suffering through the reactivity. So this can give us a kind of a context of when we're talking about divine abidings and the Brahmaviharas. Name suggests that these practices allow us to enter into certain kinds of divine abidings, into certain kinds of divine realms of perception, of kindness, of compassion, of joy, of equanimity. And the Brahmaviharas also give us a kind of map of some possible, many possible skillful responses of the heart, skillful ways of relating that we can cultivate, ways of relating to our experience, to others, to ourselves. And the later commentarial tradition, especially a 5th century text called the Visuddhimagga. I don't know if it's a, is it a familiar name to people? Yes, some nodding, some shaking of their heads. So it's a Visuddhimagga, the Path of Purification, written by a person called Buddhaghosa, a Sri Lankan traditional text that was very influential in the Theravadan world, or continues to be. And one of the things it does, it's a huge compendium, but it delineates with the Brahmaviharas so-called near and far enemies. concept of near and far enemies. So qualities that are, the near enemies being qualities that are similar to what it is we're wanting to cultivate, but not quite the same thing. And far enemies being exactly the opposite on a kind of emotional level. So if we think of an example with metta practice, if you find yourself thinking of someone and you feel like, oh, this would be such a great person to practice metta to, so easy to feel metta towards them, this is such an attractive person. And then if that's the thinking, if you're thinking this is there's attraction there, then Buddhaghosa has some news for you. This isn't exactly metta in that case. There's something else mixed in there with the longing of the heart and the movement of the heart. So with metta, the near enemies are attraction and attached love or conditional love. Love that wants something in return. So this is a difference from metta. And just to be clear, this discernment and seeing the difference between metta and attached desire, we're not offering it as a kind of a moralistic judgment of one is good and the other one is bad. We're not suggesting that we should only aspire to feel purely metta and the Brahma Viharas. The so-called near and far enemies, many of them actually are completely healthy, appropriate human emotions, movements of the heart. And we're not in the project is not to eradicate them or to get rid of them. But the reason for this discernment is in the cultivation of, for example, metta, of this kindness, loving kindness and friendliness and care, the near enemies don't open up meditatively in the directions of letting go in the same ways as the Brahma Viharas do. So that's the crucial distinction. It's like the Brahma Viharas enable a certain kind of meditative trajectory that leads towards very particular kinds of well-being and letting go and freedom and a very skillful meditative relationship towards one's experience. They enable a kind of path of unfolding that supports samadhi, this gatheredness of attention in a very particular way, supports insight in a very particular way. And the far enemy of metta is aversion or hatred or ill will. And this is actually also quite interesting in the bigger picture of these practices, because it's not unusual for people engaging in practice with the Brahma Viharas or practice with metta, that what you find arising is actually the opposite of the quality that you're intending to cultivate, that you're interested in developing. So you're in the middle of a silent sit, inclining the mind towards metta, and what you find arising is you're caught up in some very heated argument with someone else. Maybe it's a real argument, you're revisiting something that happened, and there's a lot of anger there, rage even. And this is a kind of curious emotional alchemy in the directionality towards something and then what ends up arising for us. And you might recognize this dynamic from other practices. For example, when you have the intention towards samadhi, towards this gatheredness and collectedness of the attention of the mind. And what shows up, what you notice, is a sense of dispersal, restlessness. And this is what stands out. or when you're engaging in practices of allowing and letting go, and that's the primary intention of what you're really wanting to work with, really allowing everything, letting everything be. What mostly stands out in some particular sitting is really the amount of aversion and grasping and holding on and self and rejection. So this is part of a dynamic in practice. Of course, this isn't, if it's always the case, then it's really, you want to see like, okay, what's happening here? But this is part of the natural dynamic of practice. Sometimes the opposite gets highlighted for us. And in a way, we can think of the Brahmaviharas revealing to us many of the other qualities and reactivities of the mind. They get, in a way, they get seen through these practices, and the seeing of those other qualities is also an important part of this practice. So I'll say a little bit about each of the Brahmaviharas. I'll speak a little bit more about metta and a little bit less about the other ones, but touching on each of them. So with metta, there's various translations of the original Pali metta, which really has its root in the word for friend. So it implies a kind of friendliness or befriending. You could also translate it as kindness or loving kindness. Some people use goodwill. And just on this level of the word, it can be helpful, interesting to notice what word actually resonates for you, which one speaks to you, what feels like it has a resonance that feels like, okay, there's something here, this feels important. They all reflect slightly different aspects of metta and this kind of attunement of okay, in this moment, what feels right for me can be supportive for the practice to develop that sensitivity and notice what it is that feels personally resonant. One very central and maybe obvious aspect of metta and all the Brahmavihara practices is that, and this is really foundational, is that they can be cultivated. But it's like, it's possible to do that. And hopefully, perhaps that's obvious to you for signing up on a retreat like this, but it's something that can slip the mind sometimes. It's like it can be easy to project when the heart is a little bit closed, to think like, okay, other people, you know, someone else might be of the nature that they're able to, they're naturally kind or warm or compassionate, and that's the kind of person they are, and I'm another kind of person. And have that self-view. So just that kind of baseline remembering of, okay, it's actually possible to cultivate this. It's possible to open up meditatively. It's possible to engage in practices that allow for this to deepen. With all of the Brahmaviharas and metta, it can also be easy to evaluate the practice in terms of how am I feeling in this moment? What's the feeling in the heart? And kind of measure a little bit. It's like, okay, now I feel a little bit of warmth. I feel a little bit of connection to people. That means that practice is going, something is happening and it's going well. And then there's other times when it feels like, okay, the heart's closed. Actually, there's less on the level of feeling. And then it's like, okay, the practice isn't working. I'm failing somehow. This isn't right. And it can be helpful to reorient the practice around intention. Intention being really central in the practice of metta. So you can think of metta as really a practice of attuning to and cultivating the intention towards kindness, towards care. And in centering this intentionality or aspiration, whether I'm actually feeling something in the moment or not becomes a little bit secondary. it can still be helpful to track that. We're a little bit interested in that. That will be supportive for lots of things, for sensitivity, for listening, for samadhi. But it doesn't have to be the most important thing. It doesn't have to be the primary thing. And the implication is we can actually practice metta even when we're not feeling the emotional quality right there in the moment. So it doesn't, it in a way, frees us to practice. I might be having a bad day, or not such a great day, or not such a great moment on the retreat, and still it's like the heart feels closed, but it's like I can bring the intention. I can bring the intention for kindness, for care towards myself, towards my experience, towards others. It doesn't have to be connected to this is how I'm feeling. And there's kind of a liberation in the practice. It's like metta becomes possible. It's possible in all kinds of conditions. Metta, like the other Brahma Viharas, is also talked about as being immeasurable. So having this quality of boundlessness and unconditionality. So quite high meditative ideals. And part of that, what it's speaking to is that the quality of metta is open to all phenomena, it's open to all beings. I don't have to align the metta with my preferences. And that's also a kind of liberation. It's like it doesn't have to fit my my boxes, and it's like whether I get on with a particular person or not. It's like, no, I can actually aspire to offer metta to all beings, to anyone and everyone. And this also means extends to those parts of myself that I would maybe judge or have some dislike towards. It feels like, okay, this is actually harder to love. I don't like this aspect of myself. But it means with the metta, it's like I can hold that. I can turn that towards all parts of myself. This is again a really huge, such a beautiful dimension of the metta practice. And quite profound in the way that metta doesn't create the dualities of the liked and the disliked in the same way that our more reactive mind does. Metta, like the other Brahma Viharas, can also be an important nourishment for the citta, for the citta being the Pali word for both mind and heart. We talk about the heart mind. So there's an aspect to these practices of nourishment, of feeding, of supporting. We're always in some kind of way of relating, in some kind of relationship with our minds. And this can be quite, in a way, difficult or antagonistic on a retreat like this. There's like the mind can really not behave in the ways that we would wish it to. There can be much of the restlessness, the irritability, the difficulties, and it can be easy to get caught up in those difficult dynamics. With metta, there's a lot of letting go and acceptance, and it's actually, we can notice it begins to heal some of the relationship to the mind, to the heart, to the body, and can be such a beautiful way of practicing. We'll touch on it later, on extending the metta towards different aspects of your being. And all of these qualities and these practices are a huge support for samadhi, the collectiveness and gatheredness of attention, of mind, of heart. What we could call the energetic harmonization of the mind and the body and the attention. And a mind, heart nourished by metta can settle more easily and more naturally. So metta, as I know, is familiar to many of you, can become a kind of a pathway to samadhi, to this gatheredness and well-being. So I was thinking as I was reflecting on these ideas and sort of thinking about all of these benefits of metta, in addition to all of these ideals of boundlessness and leading to samadhi and supporting being a fertile ground for insights, and supporting actually the soul-making practices once we move in that direction. All of that is very important, and I feel like there's something a little bit utilitarian in talking about metta and the Brahma-viharas in that way. It's like, okay, I feel like it's a sales speech of like, you should do it for all of these reasons. And it's true. And also there's such a profound beauty and a practice, profound beauty in the practice in itself. Or there's a, I think one of the biggest gifts of metta for me is somehow touching in on this kind of basic goodness of the heart, basic goodness of oneself. And it's like, there's something hugely healing in that, in just allowing yourself to practice in this way and occasionally opening up to this sense of the goodness of well-wishing. Yeah, and it's like, I can't really say more about it, but that feels like it doesn't have to be a huge meditative experience that opens up in any particular way or direction, but there's something really beautiful and healing in that in itself. Not to overlook that, and that can be, there can be, in a way, it's quite a simple and natural and beautiful level of the practice. And transformational. Okay. So that's some reflections on metta. And the next of the four Brahma Viharas is compassion. And again, if we look at the commentarial traditions, they talk about how the willingness to turn towards suffering is what's called the proximate cause for compassion. So this means it's the necessary first step in giving rise to compassion, this capacity to turn towards suffering. And this is actually quite important for us to understand. It's supportive to understand as we're on this retreat, wanting to cultivate metta, wanting to cultivate compassion. So sometimes compassion is talked about as the natural reaction of metta, or the natural reaction of the heart when it's open, when it meets suffering. It turns into compassion. So compassion requires, you could say, two elements. It's like the openness of heart and the willingness to turn towards the difficult, turn towards the dukkha, the suffering. And there's actually a couple of words for compassion in Pali, in the original language of the early Buddhist texts. And one of these is anukampa, which translates as trembling with, the heart trembling with. And this is actually a little bit similar to the Finnish myötätunto, to feel with, to feel alongside. And also not so different from the English compassion, to suffer with, coming from the Latin. So it's like all of these words, all of these expressions and etymologies are pointing to something, some quality of empathy, of feeling with, of being able to resonate with some emotion, being able to turn towards and open to an experience of suffering. And again, maybe day one, first full day, maybe it's obvious this isn't always the natural poise of the mind or the natural habitual reaction of the mind. When we see suffering, the mind doesn't, at least my mind doesn't naturally kind of go, suffering, let me turn towards this with my full heart and curiosity and openness. There's other reactivities that arise. The habitual reaction to suffering is often to want to get away, to turn away, to shut down. And this is part of what we're working with. And certainly, we could say the culture that we're immersed in offers us a lot of support for that, a lot of strategies for avoiding the difficult, avoiding the suffering, sort of like very fortunate in that sense, that there's a lot of different strategies and opportunities to try and avoid the difficult. So on a very basic psychological level, this turning towards suffering with a spirit of kindness, of care, is actually something quite radical. It's quite a radical meditative movement to choose, okay, I will turn towards the difficult with the openness of my heart and really hold it, really want to come close to it and understand it. And the early Buddhist Dharma teachings actually name four so-called near enemies to compassion. So just to touch on them again, it's useful to kind of get a lay of the landscape, of the land of practice, of what can come up. So one being fear. It's like the whole idea of turning towards suffering, turning towards the difficult, actually brings up fear, and this reaction of not sure if I want to do that or if it's going to be too much. Especially if we look at the framing of compassion as kind of immeasurable and limitless. It's like the aspiration, the kind of practice aspiration, is we open up to the suffering of the world and the suffering of all beings. Very natural for the heart to feel like, not, I'm not sure if I'm ready to do that. I'm not sure if that's a good idea. And that might actually be a good intuition at this stage. We'll move towards the limitlessness gradually. But just to recognize that, again, if that's part of the reactions that may come up. Another possible reaction is anger with turning towards the suffering, especially turning towards more complex parts of suffering, or maybe some injustice either in the world or something that we've encountered, and instead of compassion, anger arises. And again, it might actually be a justified and healthy response that we really need to feel and sense and turn towards and give space to. So not to be too quick to feel like, oh, I should be feeling compassion. Actually, there might be a healing in the sensing of the anger. And this is to discern the anger. It's like sometimes it can just be habitual. It's like the mind goes into the rant of the difficulty and noticing what's happening there, and then in a way hijacks the compassion practice. Another one of the near enemies, pity. This is pity, the English word, not piti, the Pali word. So again, quite close as a kind of emotional quality to compassion. But there's something of, there's a kind of equality in compassion, of a sense of really, I recognize this and I'm on the same level. Whereas if someone is pitying us, or if we're pitying someone, there's a kind of a difference in the levels of kind of looking down and not really connecting on the heart level. In sort of authentic compassion, there's a sense of shared humanity and kind of unity in that. I'm often thinking of the Thai forest master Ajahn Buddhadasa, who would often begin his talks with an introduction of addressing his audience and saying, brothers and sisters in suffering, as this kind of acknowledging of the common humanity on the level of suffering. There's that to me, I don't know how it is for you, but there's a resonance of, okay, of some kind of compassion there, of acknowledging the shared nature of that. Another possible near enemy, as I said, there's four of them for compassion, is grief. So again, can be such a healthy, appropriate emotion in so many, both in our personal lives, in the face of loss, or looking at the world that we're in, where there's a lot of cause for grief and there's a lot of reasons for us to feel that, and it's appropriate, and there's space for that on this retreat. But just again, it can be useful to make the discernment, the distinction. This is actually slightly different from the compassion. So grief being compassion has a kind of a natural, it's a sustainable, nourishing emotion. It's something that it feels like as I turn towards the difficult, as I turn towards the suffering with compassion, it feels like I can stay with this. The compassion is stronger, it's able to hold it. There's some buoyancy there with the suffering. It changes something of the quality of it. And often with grief, this is not necessarily present. Grief is still important to feel and acknowledge, but it doesn't it won't sustain in the ways and open and deepen in the ways that compassion will. The so-called far enemy of compassion is cruelty. So this intentional desire or impulse to hurt someone. And actually with that, with all of the Brahma Viharas, there can be a kind of idealization. It's easy for us to have spiritual ideals of how we should be, how my mind should be, how my heart should be, how I should be as a practitioner. And sometimes seeing the near or far enemies as we practice, they show up, and seeing the kind of imperfection of the human heart on that level can provoke self-judgment or shame. And I feel like the meditative psychology of the Buddhist tradition and all of this naming of these different emotional qualities around the Brahma Viharas actually does quite a good job in saying, if we practice, we'll all have our kleshas. Even if we don't practice, we still have the kleshas. So better to practice, get some hand on it. But we'll have kleshas. We'll have, the kleshas are sometimes translated as the defilements, as the afflictive emotions, the less wholesome qualities. And they're also really part of the mind, part of the heart, part of our humanity. And actually, I feel like there's something very healthy in naming all of that, and there being space for that in the whole of the Dharma teachings, and really acknowledging this is actually part of what we're practicing with. This is part of what we're really interested in seeing and understanding when we turn towards the qualities of the heart, the Brahma Viharas. So I remember actually years ago in my practice kind of going through a phase of feeling a little bit somehow uninspired and confined by the framework of the Brahma Viharas, of feeling like maybe holding on, in retrospect thinking like maybe I was holding on too tightly this kind of ideal of this is what how the practitioner is. It's like these are the four qualities that I'm allowed to feel to be a good practitioner. No one was saying that, but there was some sort of acrobatics in my mind that I took that on. I was like, okay, this feels a little confined. It's like like I'm also really angry and irritable and petty and all of that. So just if that's the case for you, if you're feeling that sort of sense of like, oh, do I have to be really squeaky clean to be to be practicing here, to be really pure? Making some space for that, making space like, okay, it's like we're really opening to the whole spectrum of emotions with the Brahma Viharas, with the more difficult. Really interested in seeing all the movements and reactivities of the heart and the mind, everything that arises that can be so insightful to really turn towards and make space for that. And that there's space for you to be other things as well beyond the Brahma Viharas. So the third of the Brahma Viharas, mudita, sometimes talked about as sympathetic joy or joy in the joy of others. Again, I feel like this is maybe one that gets a little bit less sort of exposure and practice in the teachings and the culture. And often when I think about mudita, I very naturally think about a friend of mine who at some point I noticed how I felt very sort of safe or comfortable sharing. If something good had happened, I would be able to share it with this person and I would feel this sort of really authentic celebration for it. And being quite struck by like, ah, oh, this is such a nice quality that I don't, noticing in some other contexts, feeling like, oh, I can't actually, it's better if I don't share too much about something good that's opened up because of the way that it gets received. And of course, knowing that for myself as well, it's like it's not always easy to hear someone has something really beautiful happen. It depends on how we're able to receive it. There's a lot of freedom in this quality. There's a lot of, a lot of sort of relational freedom. And the near enemies of mudita are either overexcitement of going a little bit over the top with it, or another one that I found reference to is insincere flattery. So being a little bit like, that's really great. Not completely coming from the heart, you know. We try to do that. Very human, all of the responses. And the far enemy is actually envy or jealousy or resentment. So again, a really human, such a human response of the heart. And actually, because the Brahma Viharas are, you know, you may be getting a sense, they're deeply relational. They're about our relationship with others, also with ourselves, but with others, the world, with our own heart and mind. It means the near and far enemies are also equally relational emotions. It's like jealousy or envy, relational emotions. They arise in context with someone else. So some of these are actually quite interesting in the context of a retreat or of practice of culture or practice culture, practicing in general. And if we look at an emotion like jealousy, which is really, in a way, having the desire for something that someone else has and the resentment that can arise with that, this is arising out of some kind of dynamic of comparing self with other. And again, if I think of my own life of practice, it's certainly something that I recognize, that I know from my own practice, remembering long retreats and sort of Q&A sessions and talking with people after retreats and sort of having the sense of like, ah, someone else is really, like, things are really opening for them on the path. And here I am really struggling with my own practice. It's not opening in the same way. The kind of how to hold that wisely. And it's like, it wasn't a kind of overflowing mudita every time. It's like other contractions happen. And again, all of this will, in a way, the Brahma Viharas give space for us to see all of that, name all of that. And it's like, ah, okay, this is here. how do I work with this? How do I acknowledge this, recognize it? Let the attention hold that, notice the suffering there, bring in some equanimity, some kindness. And finally, equanimity, the fourth of the these four. And we could speak of this as a steadiness of the heart, or sometimes talked about as a kind of unshakableness, unshakable quality of the heart in the face of difficulties, changing circumstances, adversities. And again, it's a very high ideal. It's a very high meditative ideal, because it's like where the heart is sensitive, the mind is reactive, where often most naturally the mind and the heart are caught in reactivity with the world, with our circumstances. And again, we'll be speaking more about each of these, but just to say, equanimity, it's a quality of the heart that can arise in a lot of different ways. And just to outline a few, one way we could say is through holding skillful views. So it's like whenever we're, let's say, all the time, we have different kinds of views arising in the mind. We're in a way holding different views. And the Buddhist meditative tradition offers views that allow for letting go, invite the mind to really, mind and heart to really pacify and deepen, allow equanimity to arise through engaging in skillful contemplation, skillful reflection. This is one way of finding our way towards equanimity. Another way is through a more sort of direct letting the attention rest with something peaceful. So letting the mind rest in silence and stillness. It's like, again, probably familiar to many of you, if you choose a kind of wise, skillful object for the attention and the mind begin to take on some of the qualities of that object. So sometimes the attention will very naturally open up to the sense of silence on retreat, in the hall or somewhere else. And you notice, the mind can just rest with this quietness, with this silence. And if you stay with that, it's the mind begins to find its way to a kind of natural equanimity. It becomes like, actually the mind finds its way to a less disturbed space. And then the things that felt, you know, when the mind is in a more reactive space, that feel provoking, feel difficult in that space of silence and quietness, it's like, they don't actually provoke the same kind of reaction. So just to name these different avenues that we'll be picking up. And the near enemy of equanimity is disinterest, of not caring, of spacing out. Just to make sure that's not actually what we're talking about with equanimity. So it's some kind of shutting out or some kind of disinterest. And again, noticing the differences in these qualities, equanimity can have a lot of openness towards what's happening, a lot of interest. In the silence, there can be a real sort of brightness and presence in the stillness that's really fully there. And I'd like to finish this talk by sharing a quote from a 14th century Christian mystic, Meister Eckhart. And he's actually talking about, I chose this quote because he has a very beautiful way of talking about this quality of equanimity. Interestingly, the English translation is for this sermon is called On Disinterest. So, but when you listen to it, you get a sense it's not disinterest in the way that of the near enemy that he's talking about, because there's this meditative opening towards sensitivity towards beauty, towards divinity. And again, it's kind of in the, it's obviously in the 12th century, 13th century context of Christianity. So there's a lot of reference to divinity and God, but we can. So I know for some people that may be very resonant and sort of, it'll be easy to hear that and feel that. And you can also hear it like, okay, how does this translate for whatever frameworks of thinking about meditative practice are alive for me? So he writes on disinterest. I have read much of what has been written, both by heathen philosophers and the sages in the Old and New Testaments. He was actually, it sounds judgmental, but he was actually a big fan of the so-called heathens. So it's like, it's not as judgmental as it might come across. I have sought earnestly and with great diligence that good and high virtue by which man can draw closest to God and through which one may best approximate the idea God had of him before he was created, when there was no separation between man and God. And having delved into all this writing as far as my intelligence would permit, I find that high virtue to be pure disinterest. That is, detachment from creatures, detachment from the created, we could say. So he's saying this is the highest virtue. Our Lord said to Martha, unum est necessarium, which is to say, to be untroubled and pure, one thing is necessary, and that is disinterest. The teachers praise love, and highly too, as St. Paul did when he said, no matter what I do, if I have not love, I am nothing. Nevertheless, I put this interest higher than love. My first reason is as follows. The best thing about love is that it makes me love God. Now, it is much more advantageous for me to move God toward myself than for me to move toward him. For my blessing in eternity depends on my being identified with God. He is more able to deal with me and join me than I am to join him. This interest brings God, you could say, the ultimate, to me, and I can demonstrate it in this way. Everything likes its own habitat best. God's habitat is purity and unity, which are due to disinterest. Therefore, God necessarily gives himself to the disinterested heart. Let's sit quietly for some moments.